This message was presented at the DYC 2013 conference, Before Man and Angels, in Orlando, Florida. For other resources like this, visit us online at www.dycweb.org.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Yonker, and I am a PhD student in religion at Andrews University. I am currently in the dissertation phase, so lots of writing. And I'm interested in the topics of freedom and time, and that relates to theodicy in a lot of different ways. And so I also, of course, when looking at the Bible, have an interest in the story of Job, because it definitely relates to these kinds of themes. And so that is what I will be sharing about today, is Job, and offering a little bit of a different perspective to try and, my goal is always to try and, you know, twist your mind a little bit so that you can think in different ways and sometimes see some old problems. Remember, Job is a book of questions and suffering and problems. And so I like to, you know, take the opportunity to really stretch our minds and to help us think about some of these more difficult questions and some fresh, interesting ways. So we will be looking at Job in three parts, if you continue to join us. Job Part 1. And I'm going to take a little bit of a different approach to it. Actually, before I begin, let me offer a word of prayer. Dear Father in heaven, I ask as we begin this talk, looking into the life of Job, that our hearts and minds can be prepared to learn and to think about some of the most difficult questions that face us, and that is the suffering of people, especially good people. And we ask that your Spirit will guide us and help not only us, but maybe those around us that we can share with them more of your love and bring them into a more full understanding of who you are and why you do and permit the things you do. In your name we pray. Amen. All right, Job Part 1. And the title of my talk is a little bit different than what's in the program. It is Without a Curtain or Dressing Room, The Play as Real Life. So that's just kind of making off of if you have a stage play, you know, normally the rest of the story is kind of buried behind in the dressing room and behind the curtain as you're waiting for the play to begin. But I want to approach the story of Job without the curtain and without the dressing room and jump right into it to see the story in a little bit of a different way. So that's kind of be my approach. And I think it might can be a helpful path to understand some of the questions in the story of Job. I want to briefly open by noting the importance of Job's story, his book in the Bible. Ellen White notes that Moses, while preparing for his ministry during his confusing time in the wilderness, wrote the book of Genesis and also the book of Job, and commented that they would be read, I think both books, with the deepest interest by the people of God until the end of time. And I most certainly agree that Genesis and Job contain material that is of deep interest to all readers and will continue to be until the end of time, the close of time. So, again, to explain my approach, in part one I will be sharing Without a Curtain or Dressing Room, the play is Real Life, to kind of help take you into Job's life experience without the prologue and conclusion. That's the key thing I want to do as I initiate you into the story of Job here, is to bring you in without the prologue and conclusion. I want you to think like Job. Understand? That's what I want you to do, because I think it will help us see the story of Job in a different way, and I know that many of you are already familiar with the prologue and conclusion, because most of the time when pastors or other teachers talk about this story, that's what they read. And so we're going to focus a little bit more on Job as Job. And not share that information at the beginning, because I think it can help us understand the questions that he's asking. In part two, friends and foes, the dangers of common sense theology. I won't explain that too much right here. I'll do that at the beginning of part two. But common sense is both a good thing, a marvelous, wonderful thing that we should all be following in our lives on a regular basis. When you come to a street, you want to look both ways. You know, common sense. Always do what makes sense, and don't try and stretch the boundaries of what seems like reasonable courses of action. However, in theology, for a variety of reasons, that can be a problem. And I will share a little bit more about that in part two as we dig into the dialogues of Job's three friends and point towards some interesting applications for how we should and can understand theodicy in that context. And in part three, Wisdom's Recluse, or Revealing the Veil, I will attempt to give somewhat of a fresh response to the classic questions that we ask as readers of Scripture and readers of the story of Job that might be more satisfying than some answers have been, but reorient the way that our minds think about the question. And that's why I use this kind of clever title, Wisdom's Recluse. That's a reference to God. And Revealing the Veil is an attempt to not focus on the compartments. Like when you have a veil, you know, separating rooms, you know, like a curtain, we're normally thinking about what's on the other side of the curtain. So when you're in one side of a room and there's a curtain separating it, what's on the other side? What's in the dressing room of the play, you know, thing? So how are they putting on their costumes? What's the real story? What are the real characters and people like? And I'm going to try and shift focus and talk about what the veil itself or the curtain itself actually is and what role it plays in how we understand Wisdom's Recluse or God. So what is God's curtain? What really is his curtain? So we're going to look at revealing what the curtain is. So kind of a new way of thinking about it. So that is what we will do in part three. I have to begin, of course, with just a very brief introduction on theodicy, the word, because it's so often associated with the story of Job. And it asks, how is God just in light of all of the wickedness and evil in the world? Theodicy, the justice of God. And it is an age-old question from every religion, every culture, every society. No one has missed this question as soon as they have begun to think deeply and have pondered if there is a higher being or a God. They want to know why awful things happen to ordinary people, whatever that may be, depending on their views of morality. And of course, the good people in their society. Why do bad things happen to what we would call good people? Is there any rhyme or reason to it? What is God's role in all this? And natural disasters of various kinds, humans being hurt. Of course, it doesn't end with humans. If it did, then that would be very interesting. If animals were immortal while we humans came and went, wouldn't that be a weird world? But that's not the world we live in. And nature animals also suffer and die for reasons that can seem inexplicable. Of course, Paul Harvey was a longtime radio broadcast host, and he was well known. He passed away just a couple years ago, but he was well known for the phrase "the rest of the story." And he would his big thing was to always tell stories that were missing an important detail that would help you identify or make sense of the story. And then he would kind of clue you in slowly and then kind of reveal the story and say that that's the rest of the story when he would fill in the gaps. And so it was a kind of a helpful thing and an entertaining way for him to kind of hook people into the story, because they'd be wondering, well, you know, what story is this? And then all of a sudden he'd reveal that it's a story related to someone famous or this or that that we already knew, but that this was background and other details that we didn't know. And now we saw the story in a different light with this extra information, the rest of the story. And I like that in the light of this talk on Job. And the idea of God not always sharing the rest of the story with us when we might want it. But nevertheless, in the light of this year's theme, I think it is important that we know that there is a rest of the story. Before men and angels, there are those watching, those paying attention to us and observing that we may not be always conscious of. But they are definitely there, and they definitely are a part of the story. But before we get to the rest of the story, that was why, again, I told about without the curtain. Before we get to the rest of the story, I want to jump in today into Job's life and mindset as recorded in Scripture, because when bad things happen to most of us, including those around us, we often don't have time to step back objectively. We are sucked into the story. That's why the play becomes real life. to us, because we can't pause and check out the details backstage and understand what's really going on. We are always already, when we're caught into suffering situations, we're sucked along right into them. It's not an option. We don't have time to think about it, and we don't have time to prepare ourselves and so forth. That's the idea of a bad trial, is that we are sucked into it unwillingly usually, and they often don't make sense. I shared last time my step-grandmother, Ruth, who is not doing well now, and it is a theodicy question for my grandfather. They converted to Adventism 15 years ago, and at the time she wholly embraced the Adventist message, the Adventist diet, healthy eating, the whole thing, and it was just an enthusiastic, gung-ho Adventist. And she's still, would be relatively young and healthy for most women her age. But just the last 5 years, a mysterious ailment that the doctors don't really have a handle on. They don't know what's really going on. But her body has just, everything in her body has just begun to shut down slowly and painfully. Everything just collapsing. And it's very difficult to witness that and to ask why. Why her? It's very unusual. There's no reason, no rhyme. It makes no sense. And it's very difficult to observe. We're all around it. We all have connections to these kinds of difficult questions, whether they're real close to home, whether we're currently experiencing them, or whether they are more distant in friends and others that we know of. There's always going to be suffering that doesn't seem to be reasonable or fair, and that is life, and it's hard to hide from, and that is where we often find ourselves. So we're living the pain, and that is why when we look at Job now, I want to look at the prologue last, because I want to help us understand Job's perspective and how he asked the questions of theodicy as they appeared to his friends and himself. I think it would be a helpful twist rather than focusing on just the prologue and the great controversy theme around it. We'll get to that last. So let's begin. Jump right into Job's perspective. This is the life of Job. What kind of a person was he? His sons used to go out and hold feasts in their house on their day, and they would send and invite their sisters and drink and eat with them. When the days of the feast run their course, Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus Job did continually. I will just very briefly note on the burnt offerings that this is not necessarily to be understood here as a sin offering. It is more just as any of us would do as responsible parents. It is an intercessory prayer for them, in the sense of we want them, as you intercede for anyone, to encourage them. I pray for my family members. I pray for those around me, for friends. It is not as if he is forgiving them for their sins or anything of that sort. So it's just more of a burnt offering of to God, to try and be a responsible parent, to care for his children. He's praying for them. He wants them to do right, and that is Job's daily mindset. He's a good person. We can see that from here. I'm not taking God's word from the prologue. I'm again just going by what Job did, Job's life and his activities. So let's jump into near the end of chapter 1, Job's day. None of the background, but now there was a day out of the blue, randomly, no rhyme or reason to it. It just happened. There was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their elder brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the asses feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell upon them and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." That's number one. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." To the right, beneath us. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The Chaldeans formed three companies and made a raid upon camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." To the left, while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "Your sons and daughters, who were eating and drinking in their eldest brother's house, And behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. Think about this as if it happened to you. You know, cut out the prologue. Just all of a sudden, there is this very dramatic set of occurrences. And, you know, it would be hard to see this as coincidence. If one servant survived each of these catastrophes and appears before you and says, I'm the only one. Everything else is gone and dead. Everything else is gone and dead. How would you be? And I think that we can only ask ourselves in our own minds how we would really respond to that if it happened to us. Out of the blue. Just happened to us, something like that. Imagine it. Catastrophe has struck. Every part of your life, not just, you know, family, not just your job, not just, you know, some other, you know, your money, but everything, all at once, just like this. It's dramatic in one day. How could it be a coincidence? It doesn't sound like a good day. And I do hope that we read this the next time that we are personally struggling with whether or not we're being treated fairly. Job was struck fully, to the full extent of his possessions. The boundaries of his existence were fully penetrated. Job lost everything. The events weren't stretched out, no time for preparation of heart and mind. You know, it's one thing to lose all your sheep. I can survive that, I suppose. But my children as well, the same day, in the same way, with one messenger just arriving to deliver the bad news. Does not seem fair. Four times in a row to be struck right through. There is no doubt that Job's heart was crushed by this, losing in conclusion. Last, think of it, you know, losing it as if in severity. It gets worse, losing his sons and daughters. Job is going to be feeling a pretty depleted man. Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and worshipped. In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. It's an amazing person, Job. An amazing figure. To imagine yourself in this scenario and to respond like this would say something about who you are. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Soon thereafter, though, it isn't over. We have to also mention that Job was afflicted, as that last picture shows and this one shows, with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd with which to scrape himself and sat among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die." I don't think it can be any more complete than this, to have not only the loss of everything else, but then to have the one closest to you lose faith and discourage you in your view of God. Very difficult. Very trying. It seemed as if his wife was still ready to sing the doxology, just the words had changed. Blame God, you know, from whom all cyclones blow. Blame him, all creatures here below. Blame him who knocks down church and steeple, who sends the floods and drowns the people. You know, it's, you know, your theology can change depending on the circumstances around you. And Job definitely could have been susceptible to this kind of a God. Of course, Job still believed in God. That's what's so remarkable. You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. And I like the comments from C.S. Lewis when he was once asked the question, why should the righteous suffer? And his answer is amazing. They're the only ones that can handle it. You know, have you ever thought about that? They're the only ones that can handle it. Now, I'm not sure that that's fully satisfying, and I think that there's a lot more to be said and discovered about these this question, but it is an interesting attitude that Job carries through. And he knows nothing. Remember, he does not know what the backstory, the rest of the story is. He does not know it. He does not know it. And that is remarkable. Job's rebuke, even, I find, as I read it, is a relatively gentle one to his wife. He does not say, "You foolish woman." He says, "You speak as one of the foolish women." He is not really aggressively attacking her. He just seems to more be suggesting that this is a short-term lapse on her part, that her faith is just wavering a little bit, and that she's sounding like the stupid, foolish women who have no knowledge of God, of the grace and glory of God. In the gentle rebuke, I think you can even see something of Job's, people skills, the sturdiness and tenderness of his faith. In this great sentence, he again asserts the sovereignty of God. Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? Job's wife had expressed the philosophy that life ought to be pleasant. And if all of a sudden things changed for the worse and it was no longer pleasant, then there was no purpose in living. And so, she was willing to give up. And this philosophy, I just have to note and observe, is very widespread even today. It is not as if society and Christians, by and large, have learned their lesson from this. But I think that, of course, it was given to help us realize that the reason we exist is not necessarily to have a good time in and of itself while we are still on this fallen world. There are other meaningful objectives to be attained in life, even when it turns sour, very sour. When the pressure comes, when life may no longer be fun to live, it is still worth living. A philosophy that wants to discard and abandon that and leave everything as if, abandon everything as soon as things become unpleasant is shallow, mistaken, and I believe distorted. These are actors, not real people. I would not suffer to put real people here, but to have a different look. And if you were a woman, then I'll allow you to suffer with Job, since this, some of you are ready to. Now, there's a question. Is that it? And that's why I have shared it the way that I have chosen to share it. Were those the tests? Very often, I think, when teachers and pastors and others read the story of Job, how often have you heard the first two, first couple chapters? That's what we read every time, is these two, struggles, these two trials. And Job wins these first two rounds. It is clear that Satan's argument, from the point of view of the prologue, which I assume most of you are familiar with, I'm not reading it, that Satan's argument has been answered. It's all sealed. The deal is done. Job passed the tests, both of them. His health and his wealth, no problem. Job still praises God. He has passed the tests. So Satan's arguments have been answered, and Job, his health and his wealth, are not enough to sway this man from serving God. He still will not curse God to his face. He still loves God and follows him and serves him and recognizes God's sovereign right over reality, over his life. These were severe trials, again, I must emphasize, and I wonder how many of us would have praised God the way that he did when he experienced them, cold as he did, without any background, without any knowledge of what's backstage. Would we have acted as the way that he did? So the question is, for those of you who are familiar with the typical prologue and conclusion version of the story of Job, is why isn't the play over? Why isn't it over? What else is there to pass? Why is the story of Job not yet done? Why does the play, the real life play, continue? Where's the curtain? Why can't I take off the Boyle's makeup and my costume yet? Why does it continue? Did we not learn, or can we not learn everything we need to know from the prologue and conclusion, including in the prologue, his actual tests? Why is there so much else? I think there's a reason for it. Because the trials were not over. There was worse yet to come. And that is very important to understand when we're trying to grasp what God is trying to teach us through the story of Job. The prologue and the trials, the initial health and wealth tests, and the conclusion are not the heart of the story of Job. That's not really what Job is about, even though that's usually our emphasis. That's not what Job is really about. Before the book of Job will be through, we will see every level of pride in Job, every possible level of pride in Job, pricked and poked in many ways of which he himself was probably previously unaware that he had these aspects of himself. We will begin to see what God is after in Job's life and in ours by this kind of severe testing that even goes beyond what Satan had introduced, meaning Satan had introduced his own themes, his own issues. Job passed those themes and issues, at least according to our normal quick reading of the beginning and the end. Job passed. So why is there so much more left to Job, the story of Job? I think there's, again, reasons for it. We can have here, this is the existential pause as you prepare to think like Job without knowing what is going on. The triple question of who am I, what am I, why am I, no doubt came into Job's mind fairly quickly at this point. You know, what in the world is going on? This does not seem like a coincidence. It can't at this point. The way that the events have happened, it cannot seem to be a coincidence. So the existential question surely has arisen in Job's mind. And at this point, I have a summary of part one, and then I will move into part two because the lengths of the parts were not quite equal. Part two and three are longer. But I will pause here to summarize what has been accomplished. Job has lost not only his children and all his possessions, but he has also lost his health and all the pleasure of physical life. He has even felt himself abandoned emotionally to some degree by his wife. But one stronghold remains that Satan hadn't even bothered to mention. And that is the moral spirit of Job, Job's inner life, his mental life, Job's attitude toward who God is. And there's going to be a couple of different dimensions that come out about this question of Job's inner moral spirit, and how that relates to the story of Job. I will go ahead and continue for a few minutes into part two on friends and foes and the dangers of common sense theology. Now, I have to preface this with just a few notes on common sense and how it leads us into some difficult quandaries when we think about reality through the common sense lens. Last time I shared, and since theodicy is very much related to the issues of freedom in a normal discussion, but freedom is not really played up a whole lot explicitly in the book of Job. I want to discuss how common sense and freedom, which are two key issues in theodicy discussions, the justice of God and human suffering, and how we relate to God, how they play in to the picture. And one of them is, as I was describing, you know, we, even most Adventists, we have no particularly special view of science or nature that differs from how any atheist scientist would view nature. We look at the subjects, disciplines of physics and chemistry and biology, for the most part, the way that any scientist would, right? Any disagreements, some science majors here. For the most part, the laboratory science and chemistry and biology is the same as for us as it is for anyone who does not believe in God. So we understand nature generally in the same way. Now, there is something about nature as it's usually understood that is very important to understand, that is very much ingrained as part of what I would call, and other philosophers that I've been reading, the common sense attitude. And that is the cause and effect relationship. That is in nature. Nature has a cause and effect relationship. You mix two chemicals, and a certain result will happen, right? Every time. I mean, if it doesn't, if something unique happens, that would really be, you know, quite unusual, and I'm sure your teacher will want to know exactly what happened and what alien, you know, they'll immediately be asking what alien chemical solution did you insert into the formula? You know, you changed something. That's why the result is different. So there's a cause and effect relationship in nature. This is how science is understood. This is a very dominant, popular understanding of science, and it is one that we also have inherited, and it is one that, for the most part, to the greater degree, Ellen White also supports. Nature is ruled by cause and effect, and understanding the cause and effect relationships, like, for example, regarding our health, is very important, because if I drink eat lots of bad food, there will be a cause and effect relationship. So there is definitely cause and effect relationships in nature that are very important to understand. However, when we get into the heavy hitter issues, the big issues, the tough stuff, when we get into philosophy and the real challenges like theodicy and God and how he relates to humans and suffering and moral issues, then common sense will not take us all the way. This normal way of thinking will meet ends that it cannot penetrate, that it struggles to even understand. In science, a great example right now, I don't know if any of you are into psychology or psychiatry. Not too many Adventists study those disciplines because, quite frankly, especially in psychiatry, there's a lot of strange stuff that is taught out there in the classrooms relating to the human mind. But there's actually right now out there in the world at large kind of a crisis in the discipline of psychiatry and neuroscience. The latest manual, there's a special manual that psychiatrists produce, the American Association of Psychiatrists, and it's the DSM. It's a special, the Bible, they call it the Bible. That's literally their name for it, the Bible of Mental Disorders. The latest version of it, version 5, has been a highly contentious book, because they're beginning to explain and classify the human mind in more and more, I'll call it, kind of deterministic ways, and understanding how human freedom plays into the human mind, and whether or not we are free, the human mind is free, or whether or not we are, have certain, kind of controllable disorders, just the right medicine fixes the mental problem. These are very wide open questions. I don't know if any of you have any background on these discussions, but if you're a neuroscientist, think about it for a moment. I hope you can follow along and understand kind of the puzzle, the paradox of understanding that all of the biochemical functions of our body are deterministic and orderly, and then yet understanding that our mind is still free. How do we relate a deterministic chemistry, a deterministic biology that seems to follow rules and with a very systematic way with the human mind and its freedom? And this issue is highly contentious in the academic circles today. You will find very well-known professional biologists and neurobiologists that will tell you that you are not free, that you are completely determined. I don't know if any of you are familiar with a fairly popular figure like Sam Harris. He's made Newsweek magazine, cover, and these kinds of figures, and he'll say, you're not free. He has books, with puppet strings over free will, so it's, you're all a big puppet. And now the arguments fly back and forth on whether or not this is the case amongst, I'll call it the secular atheists. They're not sure, because some atheists want to be free too, so it's not like it's just, wide open there. They disagree with each other, and that's why as a Christian, when you look at these kinds of issues and you see different agnostics or atheists fighting with each other over whether or not we're even actually free, then, you begin to see some of the more complex questions of reality a little bit differently. Some things are not so obvious, some things are not so clear, and a little bit of humility and a little bit of a different perspective can go a long ways in helping us think differently about some of the more challenging questions. So I think that can be helpful when we are talking about common sense. Common sense is a great thing. Do look both ways. Do realize that if you eat too much fruit, then you're going to be needing to use the facilities or whatnot. There are just common sense rules, and you need to understand them and obey them if you expect to be operating along life smoothly. But common sense has limits. The logic, the philosophy that we have inherited in our Western culture, which is what we all primarily represent, educated Western cultures and societies, it has serious limits. And they are acknowledged depending on which questions you're asking. But we often don't think about them. We often are just, you know, float along and take things for granted. We assume a lot of things when we think about what common sense is and how it might relate to theology. So that's kind of a background preface. Now, here we have, of course, Job reflecting on a situation, and you know that some friends came to console and condole him. Their dear friend Job, whom they knew from better times gone by. And Job 2:11 shares that when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. They made an appointment together to come to condole with him and to comfort him. So at least these friends came with what appear to be noble and good and friendly desires, right? So at least they seem to have the first right step. But things changed. When they saw him from afar, they did not recognize him, and they raised their voices and wept, and they rent their robes and sprinkled dust upon their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. I've actually read a couple of commentaries on Job that suggest that possibly, and again, there's no inspiration behind these interpretations, but they were initially sort of silent because, and put the dust on their heads and so forth, not just in sympathy with him, because they obviously could not understand or appreciate or have an empathetic relationship. But they also perhaps thought that he was going to die, and so why not just let him die in peace? You know, the man has lost everything, and now his body is afflicted, and surely, this is going to be the end of the man, Job, and so they did not speak at first. I'm not sure whether or not that's true, but it is suggested comment on it as they wait for him. And I did enjoy collecting different pictures from Job and his experiences as I looked around. Now we are set for the major thrust of Job's narrative and the trial of faith of Job, which comes not through his physical suffering, but through an attack on his spiritual relationship with God. And it comes through, and this is very important, it comes through the hands of very well, or at least initially, well-meaning friends. And that is an important thing to note. These apparently but misguided friends, sincere friends who wanted to help and hope they are helping, but end up actually being the instrument of Satan to assault the castle of Job's faith and almost cause it to collapse. And that's why, again, pausing at the first two trials really misses the point of what Job is really going to struggle with the most. The physical, the health, and the wealth, he made it through. But there is a challenge yet to come that will be even more unsettling to him, that will come through the mouths of his friends. I liked and chose this picture to place right here because I think you'll see the friend on the left has kind of some piercing eyes, you can kind of see. And I connect this to the 7 days that they just sat and stared at him, that they were just looking at him. And during those 7 days, remember, they had initially come with the intent of being helpful, of being friendly to Job, of being a help, to help Job survive this very difficult, inexplicably, at least at surface appearances, ordeal. But as they thought about it more and more and more, and you can see it in his penetrating eyes on Job, their minds apparently began to shift in what they thought. They did not, stick with simply being a shoulder to lean his head upon. They realized something else seems to be going on here. This is rather remarkable what Job is going through. So I call it, you know, the 7 day stare. They sit in silence, but they begin to suspect that Job is going through something he actually deserves, that he actually deserves. And this is going to be reflected in the friend's comments. And I think we can all begin to imagine that scenario, again, absent any introduction, absent any knowledge of what happened before the curtain was opened on the play, what happened in the costume room as they prepared their makeup and costumes for this situation. They did not understand they haven't seen the script. Job hasn't seen the script for the story. He remains ignorant, and the friends are ignorant too. So you bring together these two ignorant groups of the rest of the story, and you're going to see them wrestling and struggling with some very, very profound issues. Is Job deserving? Here's his wife and friends wondering if Job might actually be deserving. Chapter 3, if you do have your Bibles, you can be following along as you may or where you wish, or when you wish. It begins with several rounds of dialogue between Job and his friends. The chapter opens with a bitter lament from Job first. Weeks have likely gone by. We're not told how much time he has now suffered with his boils, but it has probably been some time, leaving him again baffled and bewildered by what is going on. You have to think like Job to understand the book of Job. You can't just read the prologue. It's helpful, very important, but you can't just read the prologue and the conclusion. Weeks have likely gone by since he was first afflicted with this painful ailment, and God does not seem to explain what he is doing, neither to Job, nor to his wife, nor to his friends. Everyone seems to be left in the dark. And another rendition of Job. Job knows nothing of what the prologue shares. So baffled and buffeted and tormented with physical misery, he now opens his mouth with a tremendous cry, which he longs for as he longs for death. And there is our suffering Job. There are three questions that now finally emerge, revealing a little bit more of the mind of Job. But remember, his first response was, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return, blessed be the name of the Lord. But it appears that given a little bit more time to think about it, Job's mind does shift a little bit. He begins to wonder, perhaps this is cruel and unusual punishment. He begins to see life a little bit differently. Those existential questions I mentioned earlier, who am I, what am I, why am I, are what Job evidently was thinking about. You can read it in Job 3. He questions why he was born, and he does offer a curse. Cursed be the day that I was born. I'd rather have not been born. And that's not enough. Job continues, if I was born, why didn't I die at birth? That's a very heavy, heavy progression. I hope that we don't need to ask those questions very often in sequence like this. Why was I born? And if I was, why didn't I die when I was born? And to conclude it, why can't I die now? Job is in a very delicate psychological state. I think it can be definitely said. He does not understand what is going on, and he is willing to give up. Although, again, to note it clearly, Job does come very close to cursing God. He never does. He does curse the day of his birth, and he does curse what God has allowed to happen. You can see how the pressure is increasing. The weight of the problem is growing, and Job is beginning to break and crumble under it. as this unceasing, unexplained anguish goes on. He doesn't die. You know, it would have probably made more sense to him and his friends and his wife if he had died, but he didn't. You see this amazing progression from this day of calamity, and then you see his body oppressed by the boils and physical suffering, such that he picks at the scabs and the boils with a potsherd, and it just goes on, you know, an indefinite period of time. It just goes on. There is no stopping it, and he is left to ask those questions of, you know, if I, you know, why was I born? And if I was, why did God bother to let me live? And why won't he let me die now? I want to note, before we end the first session, that I do not think that Job is thinking of suicide. I don't think that's what his state of mind is. Last time I presented it earlier, someone was asking that question of whether or not they thought that Job was suicidal. I don't think so. And I think as the narratives progress, you'll definitely see Job's mind very active. He obviously begins to defend himself. So I don't see the mind of someone that's suicidal. I simply see, as I have here, that God is, I mean, that Job is ready to die. You know, there is a difference between, I think, and I'll let, you know, psychologists really speak to that, but I think there's a difference between being suicidal and being ready to die. There is a difference. There's no more purpose to life. His life as he knew it has been so utterly destroyed. And not only that, but, you know, in his current state, he can't even imagine or fathom rebuilding a new life, because he doesn't know why the boils have come. He does not know what disease or ailment he has, and he does not know that he will live. So in his mind, he can be very ready to die, because life has no more pleasure to it. He had been given much. God had blessed him, you know, sufficiently and greatly in his early life, and now there is simply no more reason to live. And obviously, I think that the book was written of Job. The story of Job was given that there are still reasons to live, even when life can seem to completely lose its meaning. And you can imagine any number of scenarios in your own personal life. And I know, you know, some students, you know, you hear about it now and then, you know, where they were trying to go on to become a lawyer or a doctor, and they fail their, you know, exam at a key point after they've already invested years into that track of their education. And, you know, so they commit suicide or this or that. You know, you always hear about these very unfortunate situations, and I hope that we personally are not too close to any of them or to many of them, but I know that there are always, you know, going to be, you know, varying degrees of the suffering of those around us. You know, understanding that, you know, when life has lost its focus, lost its orientation, we've dedicated everything to something, or we have lived a certain way, we have understood life in a certain way, and that has been pulled out, the rug has been completely pulled out from under us, that there still can be meaning. And that is one of the lessons of Job, that there is still meaning to life. And I will pause here. I know it's halfway through part two, but the length of the parts is out of sequence, and so I will pause and allow for a few questions or comments before I continue tomorrow with part two, the last half of part two and part three. Are there any comments on this reading of it? Any questions or anything? Yes.
I hope I'm not jumping ahead, but I was wondering, because I can't tell my mind thinking, comparing this and the time of Jacob's trouble. Is there any relation?
Time of Jacob's trouble. I had not prepared any portions on that. Actually, I know great controversy themes are part of my title, but I'm dealing with it from a slightly different perspective. I do believe that there are lessons to learn from Job's struggles and sufferings, and also from Jacob's struggles and sufferings, because they were also of a mental sort. Reality has the quote-unquote physical dimension, the wrestling, and these kinds of things, these kinds of struggles that seem to come from the outside. Just like with Job, the health and wealth trials are very prominent, and they are always going to be connected, usually, not always, but usually, with mental inner struggles in one way or another. So yes, you can make some of those connections, but this is a unique and difficult one, though, than even I think what Jacob's struggles are highlighting, although they are related.
No, yeah. I didn't mean particularly Jacob as the person. I mean Jacob as the event, the prophetic event.
Right. You're referring to the great controversy and the end of time. Right. Yeah. Right. That's why I understood it. Yes.
Mm-hmm. It was really inconsequential.
That's right. That's right. The word inconsequential is, of course, a strong word. And obviously, I don't think you can say that it's truly inconsequential when we experience it. We certainly won't be thinking so. But that is what I'm actually saying, is that compared to the trial of the dialogues, compared to the trial of his friend's dialogues, that was not the real issue. And what's so interesting about that is that the Satan hadn't even set it up that way. I think Satan obviously plays a role in inspiring his Job's friends to say what they say, and that's definitely part of God's understanding of the situation. But as it's presented in the prologue, this is actually left absent, and you have to more pull it out from the implicit sections of what the dialogues actually say, and which we often ignore. Not always, but often. We don't emphasize that aspect of it enough. We are so, in our everyday lives, our everyday understandings of the reality, we are always so into the health and wealth that we sometimes forget, that the real struggle is really the inner spiritual one, and not simply relating to the health and wealth, which is, of course, important, but not the one that God really cares about. And so when we think about theodicy, this is very important. Yes. A further comment? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My husband took away my daughter. I mean, I lost everything in this house. And when I think about that, that was hard. Mm-hmm. But to think about all the people that turned against me during that time.
Right.
That was the issue. That was, that.
Job.
Yeah.
Job suffered that too.
Okay, that's what I was thinking when I said inconsequential. I didn't mean mm-hmm. it.
Often is. I also didn't mention it in the lecture, and it's a very, very difficult point, but I will skirt around the issues of it in the succeeding lectures. But there's also the tendency that we have when we're thinking about these issues, or the Jobian saga and theodicy, to view it through the lens of the protagonist, as if when I'm trying to relate it to my life, I'm Job. And in certain senses and certain contexts, that is often true, because God does care about us. And if we're reflecting and thinking about it ourselves, if we are thinking about it, then it definitely is relating to us as the Jobian character, as we try and understand our life circumstances at different times. But there is also the question of when we understand the complexity of theodicy, of what has been called the collateral damage question. Did his children deserve to take part in this? The animals and the sheep, but the children as well. As I'll note later, that actually comes into the dialogues. They are not absent from the dialogues. His friends remind him of this and use it in a painful way. There's always these other questions. And when we think about our lives, we'd like to think that I'm Job, but what if you're just one of the pawns? What if you're one of the children? What if, other people, I'm only asking these challenging questions because Job, as it's presented, presents many layers of issues, and they're heavy ones. They're heavy ones. No denying it. These are heavy, heavy questions that have very difficult answers, if we can call them answers. But I am working towards a fresh way of looking at this in a positive light. But we have to go through Job first, and I think that you can really grip grip his picture better when you skip the prologue and come back to it and some of the issues that God is really looking at. Any other comments? We have a minute or two.
I was going to say, it was great with the common theology where his friends brought the cause and effect.
Oh, yes.
I'm sure there was intentional, but oh, yes. The effect of what's happening to the must be cause. Mm-hmm. There is a cause, which
oh,
is
yes.
true, but
that's right.
Use common sense to deduct.
That's right. There is cause and effect, but the cause and effect chain is not so neatly interlinked that we can discern it so easily. And that's right. Yes?
Yeah. God knows the character of Job. He knows his inner work. He knows mm-hmm. everything about it. Satan doesn't know that about us.
Of course.
He doesn't know whether we're going to do, how we're going to come through it, but God knows. Mm-hmm. And as I went through mine, I thought, God knows I'm going through this. He must know I can do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And God does.
It made it foolish to even challenge God, because God already knew Job wasn't going to fall. So why did Satan even challenge God?
Well, I don't think Satan did know. I mean, you're asking if Satan knew Job.
Satan should have known God knew the outcome of this already.
Well, yeah. That there you're jumping into right into one of the heavy philosophical questions of divine foreknowledge. I will come back to that question because it's one I've thought a lot about. And very, very quickly to tease you on your minds, as I've mentioned, divine foreknowledge, which I do believe in and accept, and I'll talk about this more next time. But, you know, it's something of a mystery, but as I've tried to say, we don't even understand what freedom is in and of itself. We don't even understand the present freedom. We don't even understand how we make decisions fully. You know, we learn more from psychology and biology, but the more that we learn, you know, that doesn't help us. It actually makes it more, you know, determined, the more determined we seem to be. And that becomes its own philosophical struggle and problem, as various agnostic and atheist biologists, you know, are revealing in their writings. So before we can jump to those mysteries, you know, let's go one mystery at a time and work our way up the ladder before we, you know, take things too quickly down some paths. So, but these are heavy issues. I know all of you, as I've mentioned, and others, you know, we all connect to this in one way or another. Sometimes more than once, sometimes in different ways, sometimes only one component of it, you know, although not usually in the direct severity and the manner in which Job, you know, it's hard to say coincidence there. That was tough, and that plays into the nature of his friend's response. But yes?
I just wanted to ask, so you say especially in freedom and time, is that related to theodicy?
It is, of course.
Well,
that's the whole issue. Besides the issue of freedom being one of the greatest intellectual puzzles of philosophy, and I mean to this day, we don't, you know, if you find someone that knows what freedom is, as I said, you know more than me and more than anyone, I think, and they know more than they think, or they know less than they think they know. I'll say that, let's say it accurately. They know less than they think they know, but the other biggest question, philosophical puzzle, is what is time? You know, time... understood as a mere sequence of cause and effect, there is no time in this. If you are at all familiar, and I don't want to tease you with things that you may not have thought about, but if you're into Einsteinian space-time, you realize that he says reality is timeless. There is no time, and that it's all relative in the sense of it's all, you know, part of one you know, continuum, and it's kind of a, you know, he has the block universe idea, if you have ever heard of this. So if time and space can be related, or time can be integrated into space in the way that Einstein says it is, then there is no past, present, future, and all is timeless. On the one hand, Christians have seized onto this and said, well, see, God is timeless, and this is all wonderful Calvinistic teachings. You know, for Calvinists, they have no problem with this. But on the other hand, this view of time as being timeless, as space and time being all part of one cause and effect continuum, also precludes any freedom. There is no freedom in that world. There cannot be. Freedom must then be outside of time. And then you have a paradox or a contradiction between of how freedom relates to this cause and effect continuum, which is part of the human free will issue in brain science. So there's no denying the problem. So time and freedom are two sides of one coin, in my view, they relate to each other. So it's difficult, heavy stuff that we don't have answers to, anyone. So, all right, I think time is expired. I, of course, am available for any other further comments, but I hope you are enjoying your GYC experience in 2014 in Orlando, Florida. I don't think I mentioned it this time. Maybe I think I did before, but since I come from Michigan, I had to shovel a foot of snow off my driveway to get to the airport. It was so nice to land in a warmer Orlando airport climate for a few days before I returned to the frigid north. So it's good to be here. Thank you.
This message was recorded by Fountain View Productions for GYC. GYC, a supporting ministry of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, seeks to inspire and equip young people to be vibrant, Bible-based, and Christ-centered Christians. To download or purchase other resources like this, please visit us online at www.gycweb.org.